I'm Christopher Lighton. This is Open Source. Radio talk on the web model, fast and free all over the globe at radioopensource.org. The No Child Left Behind law does not ban education in dance, theater, music, and the visual arts. In fact, the law identifies the arts as a core academic subject alongside reading, math, and science. But the arts are not testable, and there is no penalty for not studying them. So they're the first part of a tight budget to be cut, and in fact, they're vanishing from public schools all over this country. Our guest, the poet-activist Robert Pinsky, has a notion of what's at stake here and what must be done about it. Our second guest, the poet and teacher Abdi Ali, has an experienced notion of what can be done. It. He does it every day as a humanities teacher at an unusual public high school in the city of Boston, the Boston Arts Academy. We're talking about the arts in education this hour. Post your own experience in the education of your expressive self on our website, www.radioopensource.org. Robert Pinsky, who teaches at Boston University, was the U.S. Poet Laureate from 1997 to 2000, and he took ordinary people's favorite poems, including mine, around the country and eventually to the White House in a most extraordinary kind of example of, shall we say, poetic relevance. Robert Pinsky, you've been on a tear lately about the arts in public education. Take us with you again. Where are we going?
Well, I consider this a practical question. We have made a national issue out of the skills and the competence of the American workforce and of Americans. And the arts, in my opinion and in my experience, in my own childhood as a parent and as a teacher, Abdi Ali is going to be able to correct this with current experience teaching high school kids. In my experience, art is not an ornament or a sweet thing at the fringe of human intelligence. Art is right at the center of human intelligence. We see this in our endless appetite for music. We walk around now with music, not just in the car, but in our ears through headphones. And we see it in the history of the education of ruling classes. Ruling classes, by and large, are it's taken for granted that they'll be familiar with languages. They'll read traditionally in the old English idea that still influences American prep schools. Gentlemen and ladies read Virgil in Latin. They read Homer in Greek.
Admit I did, yes?
Yeah.
And get over it without very little music or painting in high school, but that's another matter. We'll come to it.
It is another matter. It is a loss.
Darn right.
In the school Robdy teaches, which is a Boston public high school, it's a school of the arts. It is not fame. It's not to make every student a professional artist. But practically, you see every day that these kids, probably, 75 or 80% minority kids, public school kids in the city, they learn how to focus their abilities and have confidence in their abilities through art. If you can master playing an instrument and you can learn a foreign second language, you can probably learn just about anything. It's not an accident that the people who worked on the Manhattan Project played string quartets in the evenings. It's not an accident that Albert Einstein translated poetry from and into different languages. These are basic intellectual skills, and they're more demanding, they're more exacting than studying for a test, a standardized test. They require more of you. And if you put me in charge of hiring for my company, and I hire a lot of classics majors, a lot of people who know how to play an instrument and know more than one language, you can hire a lot of people who do well on standardized tests. And I believe my people will also do well on standardized tests. And sooner or later, my company is going to be smarter than yours.
You were speaking of things we see, just sort of symptoms all around us. We also see this fantastic interest in American Idol and performance and young performers, which is another little symptom. But we're also drowning in fear that Chinese and Indian technologists are going to have our lunch tomorrow if we don't do something much more efficient in in mathematics,
engineering,
technology.
The American Idol example demonstrates that we are an art-making animal, an art-craving animal. The second thing has a lot to do with democracy. De Tocqueville says, in a democracy, you're going to have a lot of shoddy goods. In a society where only the rich have watches, all the watches will be extremely good watches. If you have a society in which everybody wants a watch, says de Tocqueville, there are going to be a lot of kind of crappy watches. And you'll have a whole range from quite shoddy watches up to quite... Well, Timex became very good eventually. You and I are old enough to remember really bad watches. I mean, now my son-in-law went for a job interview. I bought him a very convincing Philippe Patek watch for his job interview. I bought it in Chinatown for $4. I didn't bother to bargain the guy down. And that watch will keep time forever, although within a few days it doesn't look like gold anymore.
I take your point.
In art, in a democracy, in education, in a democracy, the de Tocqueville principle probably applies. We're going to have a big range from extremely distinguished to pretty crappy. That is part of our vitality. It's part of our nature as a country. And if we start having schools that neglect the center, there's a reason it's called liberal arts education. If we have schools that neglect the core, I said in my own experience, I mean, I was rescued by music as a student myself when I was in high school.
Tell that story. It's almost unbelievable.
It was the only thing I did that was any good for a while. In the eighth grade, I was in the dumb class. It wasn't officially called that, but that's how it was identified, sometimes the bad class. It was kids who were not doing their things they were supposed to do in school. We were not stupid. But we were called the dumb class. My dad had gone to the same high school. He'd been a very good athlete. He'd taken care of business properly. He'd done okay. I was a disappointment. I wasn't an athlete the way he was. I wasn't a social hit. I could play. I was there playing the saxophone at the high school dances. My band for certain years was the band that was around playing lunchtime dances. We played at the beach clubs. And it gave me not only an identity.
The band had a name, I'm sure.
Well, let's not go into the name. It's not only that socially it was useful for me, and it sort of kept me together through difficult years. I also think it gave me confidence in my ability to learn. If you have a musical instrument, it's a symbol of the past. It's deeply traditional. It goes way back.
Yep.
It's also a symbol of cooperating with other people.
Amen.
Because if you can't cooperate with other people, you're not going to get very far in music.
It's a team experience, yes.
And it's also a symbol of working hard at something that is infinite. You never completely master. It's like these computer games that go on forever. You don't ever win. You just get better and better. And that music, no matter how well you can play, there's always something you could learn that's further or better. And that's, to me, a profoundly important intellectual principle, educational principle, and life principle, that there are certain things that are not, I'm finished, I did it, it's over.
Right.
It eventually becomes like
a test.
Like tic-tac-toe, or the most complicated test sometimes, basically test material where it's like tic-tac-toe. Once you understand it, it's completely trivialized.
There are a number of interesting points here, and some of them just autobiographically. You didn't get to be Stan Getz or Johnny Hodges.
It was only an absence of talent that prevented that.
But it probably got you into Rutgers.
Yes.
And what the question with a lot of people who've been talking about this is, which builds confidence for what? Saxophone for poetry? Poetry for a livelihood. What are the steps here, do you think? I mean, the notion has become that, you know, if you're practical and you've got to make a living and you're going to do something for in a competitive world economy, you better plunge into engineering.
Oh, that's so.
And then maybe you discover your artistic hobby on the side later. What is the order of these things, or is there any?
That's the great category of bad advice. I can remember my father's friends telling me, go into the army on the 6 months plan, it's a good deal. Something that kept me from doing it would have been a disaster. And I can remember people saying, if you want to earn a living, better, you know, study something people need you to know. It turns out it's not so. If you want to do well in the world, you have to figure out how to cultivate the things you're good at. If you do that, you don't have to worry about earning a living. I'm going to try to combine the autobiography with the subject. I look at Abdi's students at Boston Arts Academy. I see something I recognize very well, that these are children who, if they understand their own value, if they believe it's possible that someone would want to listen to them, want to trust them to do work, if someone would have confidence in them, you can see that these are important people. Mm-hmm. They can do very significant things. And they are our children. I mean, you adduce the kind of current pragmatic thing of what about the Chinese? What about these other countries? In a pluralistic democracy like this, these are our kids. Our kids are not just Robert Jr. or Christopher Jr. or Abdi Jr. that we hope to get into a good brand name college. These are all our children, because this is a democracy. And if we can't foster these children, including giving them the arts, woe to us. We didn't get them from nowhere. We got them from people who prevented them. And I think in the case of all three of the male Americans in this room, we didn't get them from our literal ancestors. We got them from people in preceding generations who adopted us. Not particularly the three of us by name, but 100 years ago or 75 years ago, whether they had read Thomas Dew, whoever those people were, they took care of us.
We adopted some of our own ancestors in this tradition, too. We're talking about the arts in education, specifically the lively, expressive arts in public education in the era of No Child Left Behind, which makes it tough to do it. But our guest, when we come back, Abdi Ali, does it every day in the Boston Arts Academy. This is Open Source. We'll be right back after a short break.
Hi, this is Dave Miller, Open Source Senior Producer. Next Thursday is the third annual Blogs Day, our winking homage to James Joyce. It's really just a celebration of blogging in all its forms. In case you didn't hear the first two editions, it's a whole show made up of blog posts that were written on the same day, in this case Tuesday, June 5th, and read by two of our favorite actors. We're scouring the web for posts now, and we hope you'll do the same. Give us the personal and the political, the petty and the profound. Help us craft a portrait of the online world that does justice to the real one at radioopensource.org.
Open Source is produced in association with WGBH Radio in Boston. This is Open Source from PRI. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. We're talking about the arts in public education with the former poet laureate Robert Pinsky and with Abdi Ali, who teaches the humanities at an unusual school for about 400 kids in the city of Boston, the Boston Arts Academy. Abdi Ali, you believe in it as well as practice it. Tell us what you're doing at the Arts Academy.
I teach a junior-level humanities course on the Patriot Act and a senior-level humanities course on aesthetics. I've been with the Arts Academy since 1998. That was our inaugural year. And we opened with this idea that the arts at its core, or at their core, is very democratic. And we tried to create an institution that reflected this essential democracy in the arts. And I'm happy to say that we are the first inclusion, full inclusion high school, which means that we take students at different learning abilities, different capacities in the arts and in the academics. We are academically blind. We don't look at students' academic history. And the one thing that our arts colleagues, my arts colleagues, look for during the auditioning process is what they describe as the light in the eyes, a declaration of passion. And that's their basic requirement. There are class issues, there are racial issues, there are gender issues, a host of issues that we care about at the Arts Academy. And we ask those tough questions about race, class, gender, sexuality in our work every day. And I got to tell you, it's the best work. It's life-changing. This is our ninth year. We're going to go into our 10th year.
I want to ask Abdi a quick, tough question. Okay. Abdi, how do your students do on the MCAS exam?
Which is the standardized state required test. Go ahead.
Here's the thing. I think they do well. Mm-hmm. And they do well over time. The question for us is not to substantiate arts learning on the basis of some testing.
I understand that.
Yeah, but to substantiate arts learning for its own sake.
Yes.
And for life's sake.
But on the way to that,
yes,
they actually do well, don't they?
They do well.
Yeah.
And there's lots of research to show that students who actually spend hours working at an instrument, drawing, painting, hanging out in school building to act and to dance are actually students who have the skill set.
The jargon would be study skills.
Yeah, the study skills.
Before you get to study skills, I want to ask you about that light. Okay. It reminded me of an amazing, a wonderful Robert Louis Stevenson story about his own boyhood carrying lamps, little lamps under their coats in the wilds of Scotland. And it was kind of a secret among them, but they knew you've got a light and I've got a light. What is that light you're looking for? And how do the kids express it?
There's so many stories. Oftentimes that light is not easy to see, discern in the moment. I think students begin to realize over time at the Arts Academy. But during the auditioning process, you have a kid, for example, who the summer before discovers the piano. And if you don't mind, I'll say his name, Kwame Brown. And he has a wonderful story. And a couple of weeks ago, he actually creates an original score for our annual fundraiser. Amazing. The summer before, he looks at those keys and he's fascinated by that. And there was an arts teacher who saw that fascination, that interest, that desire, and then said, hey, I'm going to take you on. And I'm going to give you an education in these keys. And Kwame Brown is amazing, amazing story. But there are tons of stories like that. Students who've been who think dance is, what they see in a music video, and then come to realize that, in fact, it's something quite profound. The light is there. We puzzle about it. We say, even when there is no light in the moment, we do take students, even when we don't see the light. And I think the beauty of this school is seeing students who actually make that argument to us in the course of 4 years that they do want to pursue this work, that it makes a difference in their lives. They may not study it formally after BAA, but it has made a difference in the kinds of people that they are, in the kinds of the way they cooperate with each other. Mm-hmm. Robert talks about cooperation as an important habit in the art.
And you both talked about democracy in important ways. You've got to come back to just what you mean about it. Earlier today, Abdi, we engaged a student at your school, Jay Cottle, 15 years old, a theater major at the Boston Arts Academy. Here's his account of himself.
I think that once I hit seventh grade, I really found out who I was. You know, I had that whole awkward year in sixth grade where I didn't know who I was. I didn't really have friends because I was trying to be like everyone else. But once I started looking as myself as an actor, it wasn't that I could shed parts of me to take on someone new. I just felt like it made me comfortable with who I am, you know, because once you become an actor, the whole ideology behind acting is becoming a blank slate and letting someone else take over you. which I think makes you appreciate who you are even more. So it's really going to be something that can help me further down the road. I know that I want to become a teacher, and I think that an actor as a teacher is a great teacher. You know, it's someone who can get on the level of a child, someone who can understand them, someone who can be open enough to understand them and willing enough to do things that will push students somewhere. So I think that the acting has given me great confidence in what I do, and it's really just made me stronger. And I've really just taken the things I've learned from acting, and I've used them for my life. I've used them as a way to drive who I am as a person. So I think that my confidence has definitely improved since I became an actor.
Sounds like Robert Pinsky discovering the saxophone.
Absolutely.
He's talking about down the road. He's talking about a career, and it's not necessarily in the arts. It's fascinating to me.
That's pretty common. We see that. I was in conversation with Natasha, who is visiting, graduated a couple of years ago from the Arts Academy. She's actually in Melbourne, Australia, studying to become a teacher. And she sees the link between teaching and theater, which is the art form that she studied at the Arts Academy. It's amazing. Teaching, there's something about the arts related to this question of democracy that makes you incredibly generous. You have something that you want to share, and I think that's a quality.
Let me continue to play the role of the practical person. You've told me that the students who are selected without particular discrimination about academic, just on the basis of their artistic gifts, you've told me they do well on the MCAS.
Yes.
They do well on it.
Yes.
These minority kids, largely from poor families in this Boston public school, how about higher education? How many of them go on to higher education?
Our last stat, we brag that 92% to about 95% of our students go on to higher ed.
92 or 95% of them do.
Yeah, between 92 and 95%.
I am impressed by that.
Yes. Chris, you asked a question earlier about what is the penalty? And here's an example of a penalty. Our students can afford to go to a local in-state university. However, if they do not pass the MCAS, they cannot get admission into UMass Boston, Mass College of Art, and so on, right? But the same student can apply to an out-of-state public university or a private university in-state.
They can apply to Harvard or BU.
Right.
Sure.
They don't get in because they can't afford it. And here's
well,
here's
in one
the,
case I know yeah. a kid got into Cooper Union
yes.
and couldn't go because he couldn't afford it. This is an extremely articulate young man I made friends with when I was visiting.
Andre Lambert.
Talking about Dante.
Yes.
They told me that when he came to the school, he seemed a total brute.
Yeah.
They thought he was one of their more extreme risks they had taken.
Right.
And I encountered this extremely likable, civilized character who did get into Cooper Union, but the money wasn't there.
Right, and you would be immensely proud of him if you saw him 2 weeks ago. He was in a panel discussion questioning one of the graduating visual artists
I see.
About her work.
Yeah.
And the kinds of questions that he was asking her, Nalani, some very deep, profound questions about the process of photography, her choices in image, her choices in color, and so on. And Andre Lambert is an example of a student who does amazingly well, who should be allowed to get into any university that he chooses to, but somehow...
I was talking to him about Dante. I met him. I was impressed.
Abdi, could I ask you, surely there are kids... probably in Boston, too, in any generation who discover themselves in calculus or in history or in chemistry. What, in your own view, are the special qualities, if any, that make the arts different?
The spirit of cooperation. Those distinctions, I think anyone who pursues a subject matter deeply eventually lands on the same kinds of dispositions that we care about, and that the dispositions that Robert talks about, cooperation, a sense of working on something that is endless. The way a scientist thinks and works and lives her life is the same as the way an artist thinks and lives. If you're pursuing something larger than yourself, then you have this spirit, these set of dispositions. Your relationship to the world, your relationships to objects are profoundly deeper. And I see that with my students. The challenge is how often they're maligned for thinking and believing that they can actually study the arts for the rest of their lives. That the social constraints are enormous. And
how does that work?
It works anywhere from a parent who says, "Listen, are you crazy? Are you gonna study this visual arts thing when you could be a techie, a .com? You can get into investment banking and so on." Anywhere from a parent who just fundamentally doubts that this is actually a life, a possible life, to school institutions that say, "Listen, let's remove the arts first, and let's offer more paper, pen, desk kinds of learning." And that's what constitutes learning. It's for me the challenges that my students have to overcome on a daily basis are the ones that are they don't have community outlets. They don't have supports, in some cases, in their homes, supports among their peers, supports among larger institutions that say, "Hey, listen, we want these kids from the inner city, working class kids, to come to our institutions." Mm. And it works at so many different levels. And for me, it's one of the challenging things, but also one of the things that makes us hopeful at the Arts Academy, that eventually our students are going to have more access into these institutions, communal institutions, institutions within the city of Boston that invite this kind of person, that invite these people who are multilingual, as Robert says.
From my own memory, it's a very difficult challenge for a teenager to be put on the spot expressively, to be told that it's not about learning Latin conjugations and declensions. It's about saying something or singing something or on a trumpet playing something original, expressive from the heart. How do you see kids in today's world struggling, or do you, are these all kind of natural born performers that come to your school? They can't be.
No.
How do they?
No, they're not.
How do they struggle with that?
Some have already found themselves in the form that they care about, and others are trying to find a sense of self in this instrument. And as an institution, we care about different kinds of students. Students who have been working at their instrument for a few years, or students who discovered this instrument the summer before, the year before. Or the student who is identified by a middle school teacher who says, "Hey, listen, you have a interesting voice. Why don't you go and audition for this music program at the Arts Academy?" That sort of thing. I love the range, and I think this is again a testament to the nature of the arts that you invite all kinds of voices, all kinds of experiences, and you say, "Hey, listen, let's study this together, and let's try to find ourselves in this work." And I think it's an amazing process. I've been doing it for the last 9 years. I have colleagues who've been doing this better than I have been in the last 9 years, and we all have our stories. I'll give you one more story. Rasheen McIntyre, who was in the newspaper a couple of days ago, Boston Globe, talking about MCAS testing. Rasheen McIntyre, in his Globe interview, describes himself as a 20-year-old student who walked into the Arts Academy and hadn't been in school, sort of lost in the system, fallen through the cracks, and there are huge cracks that have to be addressed, and then says, "Listen, I want to study voice." And he's graduating this June, and it's not only his musical voice that he has amazing competence in, but it's also his voice as an individual in the world. And to hear him talk about the arts, I would bet you that if you put that Keats poem in front of him, he could not only tell you that the classical elements, the classical yearning in Keats's poetry, but also the romantic expressiveness. And he'll talk about it in terms of, you know, Western aesthetics, but also maybe give you a little sense of the class dimension and the feminist lens, as we call it in the Arts Academy. There's a sense in which when you talk to Rasheen, who walked into the Arts Academy, where no one knew who he was, there was no paperwork, no paper trail following him, said, listen, I want to study music. I want to study voice. And the Rasheen today are just such different people. But the cool thing is that there's a school there for the Rasheen McIntyres of the world, for the Natashas, for the Kwame Browns. All of them are welcome.
I wouldn't have been ready for that, Robert, when I was 16 years old. You probably would have.
I think that you raise a very good thing, Chris, when you say, what about kids who have a sense of mastery and devotion to mathematics or to history? I think in some ways, the sense of intellectual appetite and mastery is more important when you're 12 years old, 14 years old, 15 years old, more important than what it happens to be. And it's the sense of mastering something. What I like about the school, and I've sort of harped on my questions to Abdi about getting into higher education institutions, doing well in the—I think the school leads the city in MCAS. It's one of the most successful in the MCAS. Is that without—Linda Nathan is genius, the headmaster of the school.
Linda
writes very cogently about the deficiencies of objective testing, and she sees to it that her students do very well on it. If that sense of mastery, the sense of intellectual accomplishment and appetite, the sense of being able to do something well and having gifts that one can use, if that gets exercised like a muscle, then this guy who comes into the school and says, I want to study voice, in that school, it will be seen to that he also learns mathematics.
Yes.
It will be seen to that he
yes.
can write a good sentence and a good
yes.
paragraph.
Yes.
I took my colleague Leslie Epstein, the fiction writer, to visit the school with me. It was Abdi's class, but one of Abdi's kids was sick. A substitute teacher was dealing with it. They were discussing Achebe's Things Fall Apart
yes.
and what in the character he got from his society, what was in resistance to his society. We watched the discussion for 15 or 20 minutes, very intense discussion with the substitute teacher. We came out, Leslie said, that was extraordinary. Those kids were great.
It is extraordinary.
And Linda Nathan said, yes, and it's a remedial reading class.
We're going to take a short break. It's all the more extraordinary because Boston, you know, has been famous for 300 or 400 years for the Boston Latin School on an entirely different model of what high school is about. This is Open Source. We'll be right back. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. We're talking about arts in public schools with Robert Pinsky and Abdi Ali of the Boston Arts Academy in the context of No Child Left Behind and a world and a country, very specifically, that is scared stiff about being swallowed up by Chinese or Indian technology. Speak truth to power here, Robert Pinsky, or speak the sense of your enthusiasm here to a country that is thinking math and science.
I think the less you know about education, the more you're likely to think that all you have to do is get the kids' laptops and teach them math, and then they'll really do well. The more experience you have of education, the more you realize that different people have different needs and learn different ways. Good teachers make a compromise between usually a quite autocratic, firm sense in that teacher of what you want mm-hmm. and how you're going to manage it for different people. My favorite writing in education might be the two essays by W.B. Du Bois on the Wings of Atlanta and the Souls of Black Folk. And he makes a little joke between the city of Atlanta in Georgia and the myth of Atalanta, where she's distracted by golden apples. And he says, if we're distracted by gold, we're going to lose the race. We are not going to be able to get to the finish line if we think, oh, this is shiny, it's gold, it's money. He says that these institutions were ridiculed after the Civil War, that we're going to teach freedmen history, ancient history, music, mathematics. And he said the wisdom was, have one generation that is cooks and porters. Then there'll be another generation of carpenters and plumbers. And then you can have another generation that'll be school teachers and nurses. And after four or five, six generations, you can have teachers and scholars. And he says, no. He says, teach cooks to be cooks. Teach scholars to be scholars. He said in a line that I love, he says, teach fools to be fops. And can I read this?
Please.
It's at the end
Sounds
of his...
Sounds like he's talking back to Booker T. Washington.
He is indeed partly talking back to Booker T. But Washington had a lot of allies, and it sounded like it made sense. And he says, finally, beyond this, it must develop human beings. Above our modern socialism, out of the worship of the mass, must persist and evolve that higher individualism which the centers of culture protect. There must come a loftier respect for the sovereign human soul that seeks to know itself and the world about it, that seeks freedom for expansion and self-development, that will love and hate and labor in its own way, untrammeled alike by old and new. Such souls aforetime have inspired and guided worlds. He's talking about elite education, which includes arts. And if we if we'd be not wholly bewitched by a Rheingold, they shall again bewitched by a Rheingold. And then as to democracy and art, he ends that essay with this paragraph. This is in speaking to the idea of democracy in art that Abdi said. It's like basketball. If you can do it, you do it. It doesn't matter who your dad was. I sit with Shakespeare, he writes. I sit with Shakespeare and he winces not. Across the color line, I move arm in arm with Balzac and Dumas, where smiling men and welcoming women glide in gilded halls. Again, imagery of aristocracy. From out of the caves of evening that swing between the strong-limbed earth and the tracery of the stars, I summon Aristotle and Aurelius, and what soul I will, and they come all graciously with no scorn, no condescension. So, wed with truth, I dwell above the veil. Is this the life you grudge us, O knightly America? Is this the life you long to change into the dull red hideousness of Georgia? Are you so afraid lest peering from this high Pisgah between Philistine and Amalekite, we sight the promised land? And he is saying basically that people in this country should have a right to aspire to whatever their ability is.
And this is W.E.B. Du Bois, probably early in the 20th century, but he's talking, among other things, about class and as well as the arts. It connects with something that a writer called Rababa put on our site this afternoon as follows. Rababa asks, does anyone know when art even became a segment of public education? I don't recall hearing my grandparents ever talking about it or reading about it. Art and music seemed to be a luxury item for those who could afford it, or a foundation for those society daughters who were told they needed refining in order to ensnare a husband of good standing. It probably was there among Rababa's grandparents in some fashion.
I think it depends on the culture. I've alluded, when you were talking about Roxbury Latin, I've alluded to the sort of English preppy tradition in which there may have been a kind of a musical appreciation and choir. It probably was not terrifically ambitious in visual art, though people, traditionally, everybody could sketch. If you read the journals of people of the Henry James, Edith Wharton social class, they all had had drawing lessons. And they maybe not as brilliant as what you see in the gallery at the Boston Arts Academy, but like the kids in the Boston Arts Academy, they had had instruction in certain basics of drawing. Mm-hmm. And they could discuss music without sounding ignorant. They were familiar with enough to get by, because it was social equipment. It was in order to be taken seriously. You had to know these things. And I think that principle, I sit with Shakespeare and he winces not. I can remember it. I can remember feeling when I did get, partly with the aid of music, when I did make it into college, I was reading Chekhov and Aristotle, and I was reading what people, my figuratively speaking ancestors had said were the best things there were. Mm. And, you know, we were discussing it at the New Jersey State University in our New Jersey accents, and it was ours. We summoned it as we would. And I recognize that thing that he is talking about. And I do recognize it in Jay Cottle, as you said, the student from BA. I recognize when I go over there, there's a sense of dignity, to use that word. These teenagers, American urban teenagers, feel a sense of their own dignity, and that they're studying the cello. They are looking at paintings by Picasso. They're looking at slides of Renaissance churches. They are entitled to and are mastering what has been considered the best. And there is a glint that goes with that that's related to the light you're talking about. Mm. But it's also saying, my parents are taking good care of me. Huh. And I'm
Robert,
using parents figuratively.
You've spoken in various places around this country on this theme by now. I wonder, how would you coach parents and believers and artists in ways to make the arts budget less vulnerable than it is, practically speaking, and politically speaking, in the context of these times? How can these programs be saved, if you're right about it all, and I expect you are?
I would like to, I think that this school that Abdi teaches at is a model. I would like to take politicians there just to visit. They had a benefit the other night that Abdi alluded to. They cleverly had students from the school circulating among the crowd of a few hundred people who were at the benefit. People were having their drinks and hors d'oeuvres. And these 15 and 16-year-olds were walking around chatting them up. And just the poise, generosity, confidence, expectation that they were going to have things to say to people of those students in its own way was impressive socially and in the way of conversation, as was then you see a show in which four or five different arts, you know, the sets, the music, the reciting of poetry are manifest. So I would get people, first you need the schools that work, as this one does. The kids do very well on the tests. They do get into the higher education. And then I would say, ask the parents to volunteer. Ask the politicians to come in and meet the students. Come in and talk to us. Talk to us about your proposal for how you're going to deal with the tax base or health insurance. Come and talk to the students. Mm-hmm. And if you see it, you'll understand that it works very well.
Let's listen to one more student testimony. This afternoon we spoke with 17-year-old Nathan Stockwell Velasquez, a dance major at Boston Arts Academy. Here's what he said.
I think that if I didn't have an art school, I would not be the student or the person that I am now. I mean, this school has done so much for me. This shaped me as a person, helped me find my goals and my reaches and what I want to do in life. But I think if I had just gone to a regular school, I wouldn't have had this, and I would have been a troublemaker. I would have gone back to the way I was when I was in the sixth grade, and I didn't want that. In sixth grade, I didn't do so well. I didn't like the school or the teachers and actually got into a lot of trouble because of it. The reason I didn't like it was too much of a school for me. What I mean by that is I'm not the type of person that really likes, you know, having a strict schedule, like you have to go here and then you have to go over here and for school, because it just makes it too repetitive for me and it's not fun. And I showed that a lot in class. Like, I tried to make it more fun for me, but by doing that, I caused a lot of trouble. And that was not something that I really wanted to do. So I have two choices. Either continue to be the bad student that I was, or move on and become a better student and go somewhere else. And I can't picture what I would be as a person right now if I hadn't come to the school.
Nathan Stockwell Velasquez will be a senior at Boston Arts Academy next year. He lives in the Jamaica Plain neighborhood of Boston. You know, he said school was too schoolish for him. It wasn't fun. It was too repetitive. What if he just doesn't like the rigor of an old-fashioned education?
I felt the same way as a student. The courses I liked best were plain geometry and shop, along with music, because they were difficult. I think that Edgar Z. Friedenberg, who wrote mostly in the 70s, is very good on the subject of, in American culture, I recognized it immediately, the people who tend to become public school teachers, certainly in the generation when I was in school, if a lower middle class family can't quite get somebody to be a doctor or a lawyer, they don't have the financial resources, very often, I mean, I was lucky, I had the old concept of the spinster, often from New England. Mm. Those women were great teachers. There's another kind of teacher where the family couldn't quite get the person into the full professional American ideal, and it expresses the values of a social class. A social class I don't want to sneer at, I come from. It's the lower middle class. That's a social class that tends to value cooperating, doing what you're told to do, not calling attention to yourself, doing everything on time. A lot of good virtues. It's methodical. It's just a tad repressive. And it certainly is not welcoming to somebody who says, I'm so interested in the French Revolution, I don't want to do any math at all this week. I want to keep reading about the French Revolution. You do what you're told and shut up.
Right. Take the test, kid.
Yeah, that's correct. And
look, I'll study the math. By the end of the year, I'll know it. But right now, I want to spend 2 weeks doing nothing but reading about the French Revolution. And that is going to seem very challenging and very offensive to the values of that class. I'm giving a very sort of rough, brutal paraphrase of Friedenberg. His two books that I love are Coming of Age in America and The Dignity of Youth and Other Atavisms. Edgar Friedenberg.
Abdi Ali, what would have been the alternative school for Nathan?
First of all, I think Nathan is an exceptional student, and he does really well in the academics. Knowing Nathan and knowing that he spends, in addition to a full day of dance and academic work, that on weeknights and weekends, he's also part of a salsa ensemble, and he's in salsa competitions around the city and around the country. He's actually just returned from Montreal, where he participated in a salsa competition. I can't imagine a better school for him. It's hard for me to think of Nathan in a very traditional sit at your seat and do as I say kind of setting.
Is there a second best? Would there have been a second best to BAA? If he didn't go to Boston Arts Academy, what would there be for him?
A vocational school, perhaps. Uh-huh. I think a place where people recognize that there's intelligence in the hands and the feet, yep, and the body. Mm-hmm. And that's what I would, the closest thing that I can think of is a school with an amazing sports program or a vocational school.
Yeah, he wouldn't have done the intellectual work, the academic work that he has done at BAA, however.
Right, but he's an amazing intellectual. But it's because it's, the entry point is through, yeah, the body.
Is the student we're talking about a senior?
He's going to be a senior next year.
What's most impressive to me, I would say very touching, moving in a way, about these kids is that they have the courage to choose that other path from Boston Latin School, mm-hmm, which is so strongly ingrained in the culture around here as the place for anybody who wants to be somebody, whether you're Theodore White or Ralph Waldo Emerson. I mean, Leonard Bernstein, they all went to Boston Latin School. That was the ticket.
Right.
For kids to have the guts to find another path And it's not a path, you know, of escaping anything. It's a path of discovering something different, I think, is hugely impressive.
I want to come back to the kind of pragmatism that I hear in Du Bois's essay. It's a different kind of pragmatism. It's not the kind of pragmatism that we think of when we think of math and sciences, doing a problem well and so on. The kind of pragmatism I hear in that essay is one about working in a society, the questioning of freedom, the strength of freedom, the quality of people's lives at all different levels of society. That kind of pragmatism is what I think the arts offer. It's more philosophical, more open-ended. But you know what? When I think of the math and sciences in the world of MIT, I think it's very much the same, open-ended, philosophical, inquiry-based, right? About searching for answers and asking better questions than answers, and then coming up with fast answers. This is what I know the politicians you've invited, Robert, to the ask will find. Young men and women questioning the strength of their society.
That's great. The other thing reminds
me... Your kids choose sciences. Do they apply to MIT, Abdi?
They'd like to. I think if MIT would consider their portfolios, the strength of their portfolios, the quality and character of their ambition, I think they would get into MIT.
But there are techniques. There are kids who are, for example, I have met kids there who are interested in an adept at computer graphics and so forth. As Abdi says, what Du Bois calls the individual loving and hating the way no one else ever has, it's like the MIT kids, and it's like the Boston Arts Academy kids.
Yes.
Take MIT to Arts Academy. Take the kids to MIT, Abdi. More power to you, and thank you for this conversation. Thank you, Robert Pinsky and Abdi Ali. You can keep talking about arts and education. You can help us work up the next shows. You can pitch us a show idea of your own at radioopensource.org, where you can also download any show and subscribe to Open Source as a podcast. Open Source is produced in association with WGBH Radio in Boston. The program is made possible by the Schooner Foundation, whose contributors support Physicians for Human Rights, Promoting Health by Protecting Human Rights, phrusa.org. RadioOpenSource.org, our website, is hosted by Contegix, contegix.com. Our show is produced by David Miller, Catherine Bidwell, Chelsea Mers, Robin Amer, and Greta Pemberton, with help from Sam Gale Rosen. Our closing music was provided by Gerador Zero. Robin Moore was our engineer. Thanks also to Susan Werby. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.
PRI, Public Radio International.